Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. As part of the 2013 Asian Culture Week celebration, sponsored annually by Creighton's Asian World Center, we'll hear a talk by Sibylon Forrester, professor of Russian at Swarthmore College in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. She'll speak on the topic East and West Connect and Compete, Anglo-American and Russian Science Fiction in the Cold War and Beyond. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday afternoon, September 9, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Maorang Zhang, the director of the Asian World Center at Creighton University.
Professor Sibylaine Forrester teaches Russian language and literature at Swarthmore College, including a course on Russian and East European science fiction. She has published numerous articles on Russian literature and is active as a translator of prose and poetry. Her latest publication on science fiction was the co-authored introduction to a special cluster of articles on early Soviet and post-Soviet science fiction in the journal Slavic Review. Her talk will briefly outline the shape of that tradition over the past 125 years and then focus in on the relationship of Soviet and Anglo-American science fiction during the Cold War, with a glance at the translations of Japanese science fiction into Russian in the same period. Please join me in welcoming Professor Forrester for her presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here and to be part of the Asian Culture Week at Creighton, and thank you to Dr. Jiang for the invitation. Of course, Russia and the West is a completely different East-West vector, but it's the one that if you had asked somebody 30 years ago, 40 years ago, what does East and West mean, that probably would have been what they came up with. And in fact, if you look at the map, Russia is a Pacific Rim nation. It goes all the way to the Pacific. It has a huge land border with China and looks at Japan across a not very wide water channel, but also has a very interesting science fictional relationship with Japan, which I'll talk about a little bit towards the end of the talk. The important thing to think about as I start talking about it is that science fiction is a genre that doesn't work if you don't like it. It's not a vitamin-rich literature. It really is supposed to be fun, it's supposed to be entertaining, and yet has the potential, unlike some other kinds of non-elite literature, to make you think very hard about what you're reading about, to make you think about how the future will be, possibly how the past will be. One weird thing about science fiction is you're reading kind of a history of the future. It's typically written in the past tense, but about something that hasn't happened yet. So I'm using the term science fiction to refer to all kinds of speculative literature, not only literature set in space. I realize that a good title for this talk would have been Above It All. I think that would be a good next time. But that was very common, of course, in the Cold War period. And if you think about one of the defining things of the Cold War period, it was the space race. So that was a very important part of science fiction, but it wasn't the only one. Now, Soviet-era science fiction mostly was not fantasy. And fantasy was kind of kept at arm's length. It was considered something, it didn't make it in until after the end of the Soviet Union. Now you can find novels about unicorns in the Moscow metro. You can find anything you want. And those of you who like science fiction, not science fiction, fantasy rather, might be interested to hear that the big starter was Tolkien, that people were huge fans of Lord of the Rings. One of the most well-known now fantasy writers got started writing fan fiction based on Lord of the Rings. So that's all there too, but I won't be talking about it. Russian uses the term научная фантастика. You got that second part right, фантастика. So it's scientific fantasticness, right, to describe science fiction. It's a term that interestingly overlaps with science fiction. There's science, right? But instead of saying fiction, they're saying it's something fantasized. So interestingly, they have the term фантастика, but what they call fantasy is fantasy, right? Good old Russian word. So, a very quick overview of science fiction in Russian. It is in fact the case that Russia has one of the great world traditions of science fiction. And in the Cold War period, some of the books of translation would say on the back, the other great world tradition. So this is kind of limited, you know, Anglo-American is one, and then the other great one is Russian. Why would that make sense? Because at that time, people were thinking about the world having these two Cold War poles, and if you were something else, you were not aligned, right? It starts with a few speculative pieces in the early 19th century, not particularly worth reading unless you're a specialist, and then the foundation is laid in the late 19th century. So the first interesting thing in the late 19th century is a novel by a man named Nikolai Chernyshevsky called What is to be Done, 1863. This was Lenin's favorite novel, and quite possibly the worst novel ever written. Not science fictional for the most part. It was intentionally badly written. The narrator kind of makes fun of himself for not being a literary man. But one short chapter towards the end called Vera Pavlovna's Fourth Dream shows a vision of a socialist future. Vera Pavlovna, who's the heroine, falls asleep, and she's whisked away to this beautiful land of fields with a crystal palace in the middle. And the crystal palace encloses all kinds of wonderful buildings. And people live there. They come when it's time for harvest. So it's this kind of agricultural socialist utopia that Chernyshevsky is advancing as a place you can imagine as your future. Now, this novel was tremendously influential. It wasn't just Lenin who thought it was good stuff. The next step, almost immediately, were several responses to Chernyshevsky and to other positivist, kind of leftist writers from someone I know you've heard of, Fyodor Dostoevsky. So the first one was his piece Notes from Underground, which has parts that reject the idea of enlightened self-interest. There are parts that really make fun very explicitly of the Crystal Palace and say how horrible the Crystal Palace is. And if I have to admire it, I'm going to put a rude gesture in my pocket so no one will see my rude gesture, but I'm making it. And insisting on the right of the human being to do stupid things and to be unhappy. So this is Dostoevsky's kind of rejoinder. The second response that came quite a while later, 15 years or so later, is a chapter in the novel The Brothers Karamazov called The Legend of the Grand Inquisitor. And The Grand Inquisitor keeps resonating again and again in later science fiction. It shows up in The Matrix, although kind of attenuated. It's been recycled over and over. And the idea of the Grand Inquisitor is an elite that takes on the burden of interfacing with reality and keeps everybody else in a position of ignorant happiness or drugged stupidity or whatever it is in the particular work of fiction you're looking at. So even though that chapter was delivered by Ivan Karamazov, who's a guy with a lot of problems, nonetheless, it's been taken out of context and read both as a very positive thing and as a very, very negative thing. The third interesting science fictional thing from the late 19th century is a philosopher named Nikolai Fyodorov. I'm pretty sure you have not heard of. He died in 1903. And one of his big philosophical assertions was that here we are, learning all of these things, creating science, we're able to now possibly impact the climate, we're able to deal with health issues, and we need to be aiming to resurrect everybody who's ever died. This is what we should be doing. This is what makes our scientific hubris something that is not just wheel spinning. We need to resurrect everybody who's ever died, or the fathers, as he put it. Now, Fyodorov was a man who thought things through. If you resurrect all those people, where will you put them all? So he thought, this is the moment, we will go out into space and colonize other planets and other stars, and we will put all those people on these other planets. Right. Now, I remember reading Fyodorov and thinking this man is as nutty as the day is long when I was your age in college. But he mentored and inspired Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, 1857 to 1935, who was a famous rocketry pioneer. He actually, if you Google him, you can see his amazing, wonderful, very forward-looking engineering designs for airlocks on spaceships, for the kinds of shapes spaceships should be. He was looking at how round things would go through space and how elliptical things would go through space. He also wrote some very bad science fiction stories, aimed at his high school math students. He was a high school teacher, and so he has one where the two characters find themselves on the moon and they're experimenting, jumping, doing flips. You know, what happens if you do this or that on the moon? Unfortunately, it turns out it was all a dream, which I know is the thing that a science fiction reader hates most of all. If it was all a dream, then why did you write it? Now, before the revolution, the most influential things on Russian science fiction works were the perpetual favorites, Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, right? But also, Alexander Bogdanov, who was an old Bolshevik, in 1908 published a very original novel called Red Star, where he imagined an advanced socialist utopia on the planet Mars, which is conveniently the red planet, right? So, in fact, there is stuff already happening, not just the philosophical discussion with Chernyshevsky and Dostoevsky, which is not really science fiction. It's speculative about the future. The other very important thing, before I get out of the 19th century, is that Russians had gotten used to using literature as a place to discuss and elaborate the big issues of society. They did not have a parliamentary system. Publications were really under heavy censorship. Newspapers were treated, you know, with more seriousness than probably is the case in our society. And yet, if you were able to write something that was just a little bit careful about how it stated the big issues, you know, what should women be doing? What about the Jews? What about the peasants? What about class inequity in our society? Right. A lot of it could get published in the form of a novel and kind of get by the censors. So this was something that was the case already in the early 20th century. The revolution takes place in 1917 and leads into early Soviet science fiction. This is an exciting and important time in the Russian science fiction tradition, because there's a revolution, and now we're imagining this wonderful new future, and science fiction becomes part of it, and it's science fiction that really is recognizable as science fiction. So the first important thing is Yevgeny Zamyatin's novel, We. This has been described as the granddaddy of dystopian novels. We is set in some distant future, and there's been a kind of world war that destroyed almost everybody. 0.2% of the population has survived, and they're living in this one state, which is like a crystal palace, right? And so We was written in 1919-1921. It was first published in English translation. It was not published in Russian until 1988, during the so-called glasnost period. If you've heard the word glasnost, glasnost means kind of voicing things, so you're actually talking about stuff that you weren't supposed to before in the glasnost period. And so, in fact, We had hardly any impact on Soviet science fiction, almost none. It was available in samizdat, the so-called samizdat, but not people didn't really go for that in this period. They had their own science fiction. Where you see the obvious influence and the recognized influence is on Huxley's Brave New World, and especially George Orwell's 1984. So big influence on those. It's essentially the same plot. You have a guy who sort of gets drawn into thinking about how his society is going wrong, falls in love with a woman. In the end, it all comes crashing down. He winds up having an operation that fixes his brain and betraying her, and she's killed under a bell jar. And then in the end, he's sort of heartbreakingly rejoined to the society that's being run by a kind of Grand Inquisitor benefactor. So this has been read often as a prescient denunciation of totalitarianism, as if Zamyatin somehow foresaw what would be happening under Stalin. In fact, being written in around 1920, it's not possible that he had any idea. Not even Stalin knew what he was going to be in 1920. In fact, a lot of the things in the novel are based on the time Zamyatin spent in England during the First World War. So there's rather like Ford in Brave New World. If you've read Brave New World, he refers to the train schedules, the trains running on time. The train schedule is this great work of literature. Trains running on time was never a Russian thing. You know, they certainly had their things, but that wasn't one of them. The next writer I want to talk about briefly is Alexei Nikolaevich Tolstoy, and there were a whole bunch of Tolstoys, so that's why I'm giving you his full name. He was known as the Red Count, because he gave up his rank and became a kind of a literary hack in the Soviet Union. And in 1923, he returned from Western Europe, where he'd been kind of considering emigrating, and wrote a novel called Aelita. And Aelita is a very silly, silly piece. It's got a love plot and a revolution plot and implausible space travel. And the Martians turn out to be descendants of the Aztecs. Go figure. But it is the basis of the 1924 film Aelita, Queen of Mars, directed by Yakov Protasanov. It's a wonderful silent movie, possibly the first full-length science fiction movie. It's hard to, I'm not a film scholar, and but I would advance that it's certainly one of the first, if not the first, and certainly the first Russian full-length science fiction movie. It's remarkable both for its very realistic footage of Moscow in the early 1920s. You get to see what did it look like right after the revolution. Very cool. But also this amazing costuming and set design for the Mars sequences. They were done by constructivist artists, and it's just the coolest thing in the world. If you're looking for Halloween costume ideas, Aelita comes out in this headdress made of metallic pipe cleaners. It's just the coolest thing. So that was not Tolstoy. This was Protazanov and his art people, but nonetheless, very interesting. And then Mikhail Bulgakov. And Bulgakov is now best known for his plays and for the novel The Master and Margarita. So if you take one thing from this talk, go and read The Master and Margarita. It is the funnest novel of the 20th century. He died in 1940. The novel wasn't quite finished, but it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. In 1925, he wrote a couple of very good, very theatrical, kind of made-for-cartoon science fiction pieces, one called The Fatal Eggs and one called Heart of a Dog. In The Fatal Eggs, a herpetologist is experimenting with his microscope and discovers a red ray that makes frog spawn turn into the spawn of these enormous, vicious toads who are extra fertile and really mean and scary. And he is going to investigate this and orders a bunch of reptile eggs and ostrich eggs from outside the country, because they don't have ostriches in Russia, right? And at the same time, an up-and-coming Soviet bureaucrat decides that the red ray is just the thing to help increase the population of chickens on the chicken farms, and you know what happens, right? The eggs are crossed in shipment. The chicken farm winds up hatching these enormous ostriches and super vicious vipers, and so you know, all these horrible monsters are crawling out of the greenhouse, and only a frosty deus ex machina, a couple of days of total freezing temperatures in August, save the country from all kinds of terrible stuff. Heart of a Dog, on the other hand, which is kind of a Frankenstein-y story, was not published until 1989 because it was getting a little too close to what the Bolsheviks didn't like. Now, all three of these guys I just mentioned had scientific or technical educations. Zamyatin was a naval engineer. He was in England during the First World War building icebreakers for the Russian Navy. Tolstoy was an engineer, although he didn't graduate. He didn't finish his program, but he bragged about how he was an engineer, and therefore he knew all about space travel. Bulgakov was a doctor of medicine who actually practiced medicine for a couple of years before the revolution. And at the same time in the 1920s, there was a lot of other science fiction, mostly of a very popular and pulpy kind. Now we're going to turn to the next topic, which is science fiction under Stalin. So what would you expect Stalin to do to anything, right? Stalin took literature seriously, and he wanted to control it. Now, science fiction is the genre that depicts or predicts the future. Is the party going to like this? No, 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 no. The party is predicting the future and setting up the future. Plus, in the early 1930s, you get a new bureaucratic organization of literature. Censorship had already been reimposed, really starting right in 1917. You get central planning, including a writers' union. Anybody who wanted to make a living writing fiction, poetry, whatever, had to be a member of the writers' union. You couldn't just do it. There was also less concern, although not no concern, but much less concern with what people actually wanted to read. Now, science fiction was seen as pulp, often true enough. It was seen as fatally related to Western capitalist-style literature production. It was seen as having its roots in adventure literature, kind of Kipling-y stuff, with a heritage of colonialist exploitation. Also true enough. I mean, a lot of the early science fiction, you're finding dinosaurs in some valley in South America, and those native people in South America are depicted as kind of like dinosaurs themselves. There really is a lot of that kind of crap in science fiction, but mainly the literary bureaucrats felt that properly socialized Soviet readers should not need sensational stuff. They should not need stuff about mad scientists, right? They should be reading about increasing cement production and getting rid of German spies on the kolkhoz and so on. Now, the big exception was that children might still need adventure plots and sugarcoating as they developed their reading and study habits, so science fiction actually does remain as part of the Soviet literary poly system under Stalin as part of children's literature. And it was mostly little stories encouraging interest in science and technology. They were mostly published in Jihwiz magazines for young techie boys, kind of boys' life for Soviet Maichiki. But it's not hard to imagine what this did. It got rid of the imperialist sort of taint in science fiction. It became a very Komsomol kind of socialist thing. But it also reared a generation of two of young readers who really liked science fiction, and they were going to want to read it as adults. So science fiction after Stalin. Stalin died in 1953, and in 1956, drumroll, you get the great harbinger of change in the science fiction scene. Paleontologist Ivan Yefremov published his novel Tumannosts Andromedy, the Andromeda Nebula, or better, the Andromeda Galaxy, which is a distant, distant future utopia. It's like 10,000 years from now. It takes the scientific angles of space exploration very seriously. If a crew is going out to go to some distant star, they say goodbye to everybody because they know they're never going to see them again. Right? They'll just be having kids in space and raising them to finish the mission. Yefremov, bless his heart, strove to depict gender and racial equality in this future. I mean, he didn't always manage, but he really was trying very hard. It's a racially mixed cast. It's a gender mixed cast. It's kind of like the early first Star Trek series. If you watch the first few, they really took some trouble with who was walking around in the background in those micro mini skirts, right? It was only in the later shows that they kind of quit and central casting was just sending white bread people to be in the background. Now, Yefremov was hugely popular. This novel really broke a lot of records. It went through dozens of editions in the Soviet period. Now, remember, this is a period where they don't really care what people want to read, and yet, after a certain point, they had to keep producing books if people wanted to read them, and it's still beloved by many readers. Now, it's surprising to tell you this, but it was actually attacked by some of the hardline literary bureaucrats who had been doing well under Uncle Joe, but times had changed. The thaw had begun, Khrushchev was in charge, and science fiction began to evolve very quickly. Another big reason for its popularity was that Khrushchev and his guys were pushing science and technology, aiming for an economic improvement, and science and technology were going to help bring the standard of living up. You know, they built a lot of very plain-looking but livable housing units. And under Khrushchev, the scientist emerges as a kind of a culture hero for the Soviet mythology. Under Stalin, a great many great scientists had been sent to camp or else put away in these special sharashkas, kind of semi-camps, where they weren't treated that badly, but they weren't free to go. Solzhenitsyn depicts one of those in The First Circle. The First Circle, the title of that novel, refers to the first circle of hell, which is not that bad, but it's still hell, in Dante's Inferno. Now, under Khrushchev, you still get these special research institutions kind of off in the middle of the country where nobody can get to them, around Novosibirsk. If you look at the map, it's way, 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 way east of Moscow. But lots of privileges for the scientists. It was a nice place to live, good schools for the kids, and you could, in fact, go away for vacation if you wanted to. The other big thing you may even be thinking, when is she going to get to this, is Sputnik. Right? Sputnik, the first artificial satellite. The name, in fact, just means satellite. It means something that goes along with you on the road. Right? It wasn't a special word at all. And it was launched in 1957. So that got people in the West kind of worried. But at the same time, how cool, how inspiring. You know, I've read some of the memoirs, I wasn't around then, but people looking up and actually seeing with their little binoculars, seeing Sputnik go over. So I'm going to talk about Russian and Soviet science fiction in the Cold War period just a little bit. You have the scientist as culture hero. You have a planned economy in education as well. So every year, the universities would pump out X thousand physicists or Y thousand biologists or astronomers every year. That this is just, they were taking them in at the front end and putting them out at the you know, down the pipe. And science fiction is back with the excitement of the space race also, even though it's less prestigious than other literary genres. In fact, the lower prestige, it's still considered not really literature. It's sort of, okay, we're doing this, but it's not like a novel. The lower prestige takes off some of the pressure that writers faced to conform to the way you're supposed to write as a Soviet writer. The same way that children's literature did. The historical novel was another place. Translation was another place. There were lots of little kind of islands of relative freedom from censorship. and freedom from conforming to socialist realism. So anyway, it didn't result in particularly enjoyable work, and that's why people really liked science fiction. So my thesis is that one reason it's supported by the Soviet literary bureaucracy during the Cold War is that it foregrounds Soviet tech and space achievements, and thus it's a good venue for competition with the West. The West, of course, in this case being the Anglo-American science fiction tradition, but who was the space race enemy, right? The Americans. So American science fiction kind of as a literary figure for the space race. And on the other hand, for many readers of science fiction and many writers, it's just as important that science fiction is all part of the same project. It's kind of above it all. It connects more than it competes. Anybody who was not a fan of Cold War divisions of the Earth and all of the bad consequences they had might like the idea of a future where we're over all that nonsense. So, very quick general outline. Soviet science fiction does include some non-Russian writers. The Abkhazian Fazil Iskander, who's mostly a humorist, wrote a novel called The Goat Ibex Constellation that's about a kind of implausible genetic interbreeding experiment. Kyrgyz author Chingiz Aitmatov. Chingiz, if that sounds like Genghis from Genghis Khan, you're right, it's Chingiz. One of the plot lines in his novel, The Day Lasts More Than 100 Years, is a science fiction plot line, and that's a real space science fiction plot line. A Ukrainian, Volodymyr Savchenko, his novel Self-Discovery, which is, all these things are available in English translation, which is why I'm mentioning them. Also, some Eastern European science fiction was just as important for Soviet readers as the Russian stuff. So the two big examples here are Karel Čapek, author of RUR, Rossum's Universal Robots, and he was the man who first used the word robot. Actually, it comes from the Czech word for work, the kind of work that a serf would do that you don't want to do, you have to go do it anyway. And then on the other hand, the Polish post-World War II writer Stanisław Lem. These guys were both translated early. They were constantly available. It wasn't hard to find them. And Lem's 1961 novel Solaris was the basis of Andrei Tarkovsky's 1972 film Solaris. So for the most part, however, the USSR was pretty Russocentric, and science fiction was published in Russian. Iskander and Aitmatov and Savchenko all wrote their stuff in Russian. So I'm going to come in here for a case study and talk about the best Soviet-era science fiction authors, and these are the Strugatsky brothers, Arkady and Boris Strugatsky. Have you heard of a movie called Stalker? Have you heard of a video game called Stalker? That all goes back to these guys. So Arkady and Boris Strugatsky wrote as if they were one author. Arkady, the older, was a linguist. His dates are 1925 to 1991. Boris, the younger, was a computer technologist and an astronomer, and his dates are 1933 to 2012. Boris actually wanted to study physics, but at the point where he was applying to university in kind of the early 50s, they had a quota against Jews, and so he couldn't go and do physics. Why not? Because that was the atom bomb, right? Physics was where that kind of work was being done. So instead, he went and became an astronomer. They started working together in 1958. Most science fiction readers consider them authors of hard science fiction, if you know that distinction, although to me, they're not particularly hard. Each of them wrote some solo stuff, but they published that under pseudonyms. So they had their stuff published together was under their names. Briefly, they wrote some early things, two or three novels that were very much influenced by Yefremov. They were pretty standard, kind of socialist, realist, harmless, nobody was going to mind. But they very quickly started to get more interesting and invented what's called the Noon Universe, Noon, or the Nooniverse, people say who are fans. And this has recurring characters. It's named after a book of stories that came out in 1962 called Noon, 22nd century. So the idea that it's 22nd century, it could be noon of any day, right? It doesn't matter which month, which date, but just noon, kind of high noon of, I don't know, achievement or something. They are very interested in depicting other civilizations with different kinds of intelligence, but they don't do one after another. There are three or four important ones they keep returning to, and usually they're kind of peripheral on the edge of the story. There's one civilization, the Leonidans, that look like dogs, and they have what we would call emotional intelligence. There's another that they refer to as the Wanderers, who aren't ever visible, but but they leave stuff behind. So they'll leave behind like a bunch of what look like tanks, but we can't drive them. Something like that. And at this point in the early 60s, remember again, it's the thaw period. The thaw, that phrasing, assumes that Stalin was a deep freeze, and then you get a thaw, and then unfortunately the thaw ended and you get stagnation. So all this stuff that melted is now just sitting around kind of collecting leaves and twigs. But in the thaw period, they were super prolific. They published 3 books in 1962 alone. They were very optimistic about the future. Their new people are like Yefremov's future people. They're open, they're kind, they're honest, they're emotionally well integrated with themselves. And they invented a term that was the well-brought-up human, right? The well-brought-up person, well-brought-up in the sense of cultivated, educated, somebody who isn't going to do stupid things. If you give them a gun and say, shoot that person, they're going to say no. Right, that this is the person that they really like writing about at that stage, but already they're showing a few doubts, and it's partly because they were starting to read more widely in and outside of Russian literature. In 1963, their novel Far Rainbow shows a planet trashed by irresponsible scientific experimentation, and what they're trying to do is the null transport, this experimentation, so that you can just zap something through space, essentially beam something up or beam it over, rather than having to fly a long, long, long time in a spaceship. It trashes the planet and all these people die. In 1964, their novel Hard to Be a God raises doubts that even the best, most cultivated person can avoid being drawn into violence and other negative kinds of human behavior. Now, at this point, the Strugatskys are super popular in the early 1960s, and remember that Russians are used to seeking social commentary, etc., in literature. So they ate this stuff up. Everyone who thought they were part of the intelligentsia read their novel Hard to Be a God, even if they weren't science fiction fans, even if they generally disliked science fiction. They would still read Hard to Be a God, and this continued to be true. People who weren't even alive in 1964, when they got old enough, would read Hard to Be a God because it was raising issues that were considered important. From the mid-1960s on, the Strugatskys are less optimistic. And this became a bit of a problem because their work was less optimistic as well. So under Brezhnev, you have tighter controls on public discourse. People aren't getting sent to camp just for writing the wrong thing. You really had to be an out-there dissident to get yourself locked into a psychiatric hospital. And the Strugatskys are writers. They weren't, you know, in fact, in the mid-60s, they both quit their other jobs and became full-time writers, and they had to join the writers' union, and they did. Their job was not to be dissidents. It was to write books. Their production slows down, partly because Arkady was doing a lot of translation, partly because there were all these impediments to them publishing stuff. There's a story Brian Aldiss tells about how the Strugatskys were invited to a big convention in Japan in 1970, but then they weren't allowed to go. And this is connected to the fuss over their novel Snail on the Slope, which was written in 1965, first published half of it in 1966 and then half of it in 1968. It's written in a form where you can split it and it makes sense. And the journal got into such trouble for publishing that part in 1968 that the journal was closed and the editor was fired and it was just a big scandal. And the government instead sent 4 other science fiction writers to Japan to represent the Soviet Union. They shifted from short stories to novels fairly early, and I want to talk for just a second about the difference between a short story and a novel in a system like this. So if you think about a short story, it's just a short story. Where do you publish it? Now you could put it online, but then it would come out in a little magazine, probably something again like the Boy's Life magazines, on pulpy paper. That's why things are called pulp, because the paper's poor quality. It turns brown very quickly. It gets all ratty. The staples come out. It falls apart in your backpack. You give it to somebody else, and they read it, and they spill their coffee on it, and they throw it away, right? But if you make a book, right, if you write a novel, it costs more to produce. It costs you more time. You get a bigger honorarium. This is the Soviet literary system, right? People are getting their honoraria. In fact, oddly legalistic, sometimes people were paid for things that they couldn't publish right around this time in the early 60s. And it lasts on the bookshelf. You can find it in the library, your uncle has it, and you find it over spring break, and you read it, and you're like, oh my God, this is so great, why did I never know about these guys? And if you're considering big issues with a capital B and a capital I, the novel gives you time to go into depth and really give some plot twists and some interesting stuff. So The Strugatskys are in the business of doing novels, so their novels were under more scrutiny, even though it's kind of low-class science fiction, than short stories were. You can find short stories by other writers that are much more out there, talking about corruption and bureaucratic incompetence in the Soviet era. I can point you to a few if you're curious. They're really fun to read. But the literary bureaucrats knew the Strugatskys were the best they had. They were the most popular with serious readers, and they were the most impressive to foreigners. There was a reason why they were invited to go to Japan. And so, in a way, the literary bureaucrats had to keep enabling their work, because then they could say to the West, see, we have first-rate science fiction, too. So there's this funny trying to control them and yet needing them for the competition. So as they read more widely, again, their work began to reflect these thoughts, and they said later, we would never have written that early stuff the way we did if we had read Nietzsche before, or if we'd read, you know, whoever before. So if you pause for a second, too, how can you reflect a different kind of future? There are lots of ways of doing it, and one way I just wanted to quickly draw your attention to is the choice of names of characters. So the Strugatskys very often give you a very ethnically mixed bunch of characters' names. If you read Stanisław Lem's novel Solaris, the part of the novel that doesn't make it into the movie, not even the Steven Soderbergh version from 2002, is made-up science about the planet of Solaris. And as you go through these made-up theories, Lem gives you the names of all the scientists who come up with the theories. At first it's German, French, and English, and then you start to get more Italian, you get some Spanish, you get Russian, you get Georgian, you get Armenian, you get Japanese, you get Chinese. And so as the novel goes along, you get this image of a future in which either we're all part of one big universe, or we all go to the same universities, or science is a kind of meritocracy that doesn't exclude anybody. Right? And without having to say anything, just by giving the names, or the classmates of Perks the Pilot, who is a kind of young adult hero of Lem's. Gender is not as expressed in these stories. The exception I found was not in the Strugatskys, but a writer named Olga Larionova, and you can tell by her name that she's a she, right? In one of her stories called Temira, there's a passing reference to Abakumova's party. So Abakumova, like Larionova, the A at the end tells you this is a woman. It tells you that Abakumova had a landing party. She was the leader of a party of astronauts, cosmonauts, rather. Cosmonaut was the Soviet word. And yet I think it's telling that it's a woman science fiction writer who's giving you this detail. So anyway, back to the Strugatskys. Arkady died in 1991. Boris died last November. Such a shame. He was very active online until very late. He had this funny website where you could go and send him questions. And now I'm so sorry I never did. Boris was this funny little guy. Funny ears. His ears were a funny shape. And very shy. But he would take questions from people. And so one of the times I went to look, because I was going to tell my students about it, some kid had written and said, what should I write about? I want to write science fiction. What should I write about? And Boris Natanovich answered, write about what you care about, or else it's not going to be worth anything. You know, it was really very straightforward, decent advice. And I'm hopeful that there will be more retranslations of the Soviet-era stuff, because a lot of the translations done the first time were kind of done in haste and not very good. So very quickly, post-Soviet science fiction, it's much more blended with fantasy, and there's a lot more dystopia. So now dystopia is their big time. They didn't read Zamyatin back when. Oh boy, now they know dystopia on their own skin. Sofia Hagi, in an article that came out this past summer, shows, in fact, that the Strugatskys are a crucial subtext for these dystopian writers, because their stuff is more optimistic and they have an idea about how, you know, a well-brought-up, well-educated, decent person should live. And so some very dark dystopian stuff by Viktor Pelevin, Olga Slavnikova, and Sergei Lukyanenko. You may have heard of Lukyanenko because it was his books that are the kind of provided the scripts for the movies Day Watch and Night Watch. So if you've seen those come from this kind of weirdly science fictional fantasy writer. there's a big science fiction scene in Eastern Europe. Everything I've been saying about Russian education and sort of planned economy of scientists was true for Poland and the Czech Republic and Romania. Actually, Romania has an amazing science fiction scene. The biggest con or convention in Europe meets in Poland and the Czech Republic. It's called Tricon or Trikon, I guess. So, in fact, there's still a lot of cool stuff going on. Now, I'll tell you just briefly about what got translated, because this is very important if you're talking about the relationship between different science fictional traditions, unless you know another language. In fact, the Strugatskys did know English, and I'll tell you why in a little bit, but they would use English sometimes in their novels when the characters wanted to talk to each other without being understood by the little alien they were interrogating or something. They would use English. Often the English had mistakes in it, in the publication, but that wasn't because the Strugatskys didn't know. It was because the typesetters didn't know. They would, you know, replace a letter and not notice. So who was getting translated into Russian? I mentioned Jules Verne, right? French tradition, of course. But it's been argued that Verne got some of his ideas from Baudelaire, who translated Edgar Allan Poe. So there is a bit of an argument for tracing even that back to an Anglo-American tradition. H.G. Wells was always popular. Well, he was a Fabian. He was a socialist. Of course they liked him in the Soviet era. Now, authors that you are more likely to think of as contemporary-ish science fiction writers, Arthur C. Clarke, right, the guy who wrote 2001, Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, who just died too, Clifford Simak. Now, Clifford Simak is, you know, in fact, the official site says he's underrated, but he was very big with Soviet readers. Andre Norton, who the Soviets, not knowing that Andre Norton was actually Andre Alice Norton and that Andre was her pseudonym, keep turning her into Andrew Norton. But another interesting thing is that Arkady Strugatsky was one of the translators, and he translated a bunch of stories by people whose names you'd recognize. Now, I mentioned Isaac Asimov. Asimov was born in Russia in 1920. He was born in the Smolensk province, which is actually right on the edge of Belarus. The family got out very quickly. I think he came over here when he was three. Came here, meaning get to the United States. I don't know where they were in between. His name is not rendered in the translations as Isaac Asimov. He's Isaac. Right, so they're keeping him American in that era. Later, when Roger Zelazny was translated, any of you read Zelazny? Is he still read by anybody? Well, anyway, there was a book for sale on this little table on the street, and I thought, wait a second, Roger Zelazny, why is this ringing a bell? They had turned his name back into Polish instead of leaving it as Zelazny. I mean, the guy was born in Cleveland or something. But anyway, so on the whole, Russian fans were much more familiar with Anglo-American science fiction than the inverse, and that's still true. That if you ask a Russian who likes science fiction, they've read all these guys that anybody who's a serious reader of American science fiction would tell you should read. And chances are they've read a lot of more recent ones, too. What Soviet science fiction was translated into English? Another question, right? How is it coming back from east, as it were, to west? There were two stages in the Cold War era. Well, the first stage was Mr. Stalin. Nobody was getting translated. Oh, my God. Nothing was particularly getting written that you'd want to translate in terms of science fiction. But the first stage after Stalin's death begins around 1962, when you get the first few books of short stories, novels translated and published from Russian into English. So the very first things were being done by a publisher in Moscow called Mir Publishers. Mir means peace in Russian. And I guess they were for tourists to buy. I can't think why else they were doing them. They were dreadful translations. They were mostly done by British communists who had come to Russia, to the Soviet Union in the 1930s. They hadn't been out since then. They probably couldn't get out, or it would make it look like they weren't serious communists. And it's just very old-fashioned feeling and very British feeling, but also some peculiar idioms that just probably were cool in 1930 when they moved there. In 1962, Asimov was asked, or he asked, I'm not sure about the publication history, to edit a collection of these translations done by Russians, or done in Russia, I should say, of Russian science fiction. Following that, there was a little boom, although it was kind of little, soft, puffy boom of publications of Soviet science fiction, three edited by Robert Magidov, one edited by Mira Ginsburg, who is a wonderful translator, one edited by Judith Merrill, a second one edited by Asimov, and one edited by Darko Suvin. The introductory material is interesting, too. It's often the case that you get your first translations of a new thing, and it's translated in a way that feels very much familiar, because you don't want people to have trouble reading it and understanding it. The Soviet stuff was immediately presented as strange. All of these new collections of stories, and they were all collections of stories, some kind of long, had introductions. Now, Darko Suvin is the most interesting of them, and if any of you are science fiction fans who've taken a class, you may know about his 1979 book, Metamorphoses of Science Fiction, from Yale University Press. This guy is incredibly erudite. If I say Darko Suvin, you'll understand he's from Yugoslavia. He's not. He moved to Canada and taught there for many years. And that book kind of laid the foundations for serious scholarship on science fiction. So that also is kind of coming out of an Eastern European background. And that book made sure that Zamyatin was part of the discussion from the very beginning. He also has a chapter about Stanisław Lem and a chapter about the Strugatskys. So anybody who is interested in science fiction in a scholarly way, meaning you go to conferences and you write papers and stuff about science fiction, knows these guys, thanks to Darko Suvin. Now, I have a little quote from Asimov's introduction to the 1962 Soviet science fiction anthology. To the science fiction fan, there is something peculiarly fascinating about Soviet science fiction. What can it be like? Of all national varieties of science fiction, it can least have felt the American influence. It descended, like our own, but independently from Jules Verne. At best, our science fiction and their science fiction are cousins. So he's presenting it already in terms of, you know, where does it fit? How are we related? The second stage of translation into English had many more novels, or they would be collections of short stories by a single author, or once by a pair of authors who were married to each other and often published together. And most of these came out in a series from Macmillan that were introduced by Theodore Sturgeon. Does anybody read Theodore Sturgeon any longer? He was very popular at one point he'd kind of lost his touch a little bit at the point where they asked him to write these introductions, but everybody liked Theodore Sturgeon. He was a sweet guy, a good guy. So he wrote introductions that were completely not scholarly. In a couple of them, more than one, he goes off and talks about how his wife's digital watch is kind of science fictional. You know, this is very different from even what Asimov was saying, never mind the Darko Suvin introduction I told you about, which is super scholarly. These Macmillan translations were presented as serious literature. They were pretty pricey for science fiction. They, you know, a lot of the prices say $14.95, and this was from the 1970s, so you could really get something with $14.95 then. They were aimed at libraries, and so they're still around. They're still in libraries. You can get hold of them. So if you put together both patterns of translation, you get both readers and science fiction writers who are reading one another. Although in the U.S., the translations were not being done by science fiction writers. They were being done by translators who did other stuff. So Mira Ginsburg, for example, translated Zamyatin's We. She translated Bulgakov's Master and Margarita. She also translated stories by Isaac Bashevis Singer. She had Yiddish as well as Russian. And just one funny story I have to tell you as I end that part of the talk. Stanisław Lem kind of turned into a cranky old man. And in one of his not-quite-so-old-man critical pronouncements, he said, the only American science fiction writer worth reading is Philip K. Dick, right? The guy who wrote Blade Runner, right? And Philip K. Dick was, I don't know what drug he was on right then. Poor Philip K. Dick was taking a lot of stuff to get the writing to churn out. But he paranoidly decided that LEM must be the acronym of some kind of evil commie committee or organization, and he protested that he was a loyal American and he had nothing to do with Lem. So there have been some funny, you know, just lack of knowledge leading to funny situations. I want to say two words about Japanese science fiction translated into Russian, because quite a lot of it was, much more, I think, than into American English at that stage, and I'm going to make a tiny biographical digression about this guy, Arkady Strugatsky. He was evacuated from Leningrad in 1942, drafted in 1943 when he turned 18, Then he was sent to the Military Institute of Foreign Languages. They figured out he had a talent. And in 1949, he graduated with certification as a translator from Japanese and English. He served in the Army till 1955. He taught languages in the officers' training school. And he also worked as a translator, including 2 years as the Kamchatka division translator, 1952 to 1954. Think of the map. Kamchatka is that upper right part, the very, very, very northeast of the Soviet Union and close to Japan, right? After he was discharged, he worked in Moscow at the Institute of Scientific Information and as an editor for a couple of big publishing companies. He joined the Writers' Union in 1964, and again, he was a bit of an exception among science fiction writers because he was educated as a linguist, although it turns out as a teenager he'd been writing kind of fan fiction type science fiction. His translations from Japanese are a mix of different kinds of work. There are science fiction works, some poetic books, just whole books of people's poetry, and some older literary monuments, as the Russians put it, things translated from kind of middle Japanese rather than old Japanese. But he translated three books by Kobo Abe, three by Ryunosuke Akutagawa, a book of poems by Junjo Watanabe, and three things by Ihara Saikaku, who is one of these older Japanese writers. So as I go down the list, I see well-known poets, I see science fiction writers, forgive my pronunciation, I can't say Japanese at all, but also a couple of pieces that probably were earlier in his career as a translator by writers who were socialists and otherwise weren't very good. So this is the attempt to bring brotherly socialists, or in one case a sisterly socialist, into Russian literature. Now, who did he translate from English? A Story by Asimov, Jerome Bixby, Frederick Brown, William Jacobs, Hal Clement, William Morrison, Andre Norton, again misidentified as Andrew, John Wyndham's Day of the Triffids, and Kingsley Amis's Hemingway in Space. So the selection of writers, there's not a whole lot from any one person. So you can tell that with the Japanese stuff, he's sometimes doing what he was told to translate. This is your commission. You want your money, you do the job. With the Anglo-American stuff, he's really picking what he likes. And sometimes it's just one story by a particular writer. But he published all of those under pseudonyms. So he was S. Biryshkov when he was translating. All right, I want to add an amusing side note before wrapping up, and that is that Boris Akunin, which is the pseudonym of Grigory Chartishvili, a Russian writer of Georgian origin, is also a translator from Japanese. And I'm told by a colleague who works on his detective fictions, which are very popular and in fact now translated into English, that he took his pseudonym Akunin from Japanese. And she told me that it meant evil man, but I don't know. If any of you knows Japanese, please step up to correct if so. So what is worth reading now? There is a lot of stuff left in the libraries. A lot of the Cold War stuff really is worth reading. I recommend the Strugatskys up and down. They're just very, very interesting. Very, very interesting writers. Stanisław Lem is in print. He's unusual by being presented not as a Polish writer. And in fact, his name is spelled wrong on the cover. It should be Stanisław with the L barred, has a little thing through it, to make it sound like a W, and mostly it's not there on the covers of Lem. But if you look at Solaris, if you look at the Siberiad, S-C-Y-B-E-R-I-A-D, not S-I-B. Very funny, very clever, really wonderful, and full of little digs at socialism. There's, right in 1991, the Glasnost period suddenly ends, the Soviet Union falls, the wall comes down, you could suddenly get anything. There's an inrush of pornography and crap and Daniel Steele and romance novels and horoscopes and all kinds of just crappy stuff. And so instead of getting Soviet science fiction exported after 91, you get a brain drain of actual scientists being exported. And this inrush of Western science fiction all over Eastern Europe for a while really set back the local traditions. In Hungary in the early 1990s, you had established science fiction writers publishing their stuff under pseudonyms that sounded American, just so that they could publish. And people have done linguistic research to prove that, in fact, these were not translations. They were original works published as translations. And the special combination of things that nourished science fiction changed with the end of the USSR. even though fantasy and science fiction are still places where Russian writers explore ideas of the future and extrapolate from current trends that worry them. The decline in the status of literature since 1991 sort of runs parallel to the loss of arts funding in the United States, once it was no longer needed for Cold War competition, this kind of cultural competition that went along with the scientific and the military one. And now in Russia, science fiction is firmly intermixed with fantasy, and it's strongly, strongly inflected by video gaming culture. It's been spared the literary slump because it's a popular genre. Of course, there are problems to being a popular genre. People don't take you as seriously unless they're fans themselves. Now, instead of using Aesopian language to carry on a debate about policy, the authors of science fiction have to make multi-layered works that appeal to both serious readers and leisure readers. Sounds more like the United States, doesn't it? That people will read you if you're a good writer. If you can read Russian, and I'm gathering from your faces that you can't, so all of this is theoretical, but if you know someone who reads Russian and you get a bottle of vodka and ply them with the vodka, they can find all of the Cold War stuff online. And all of Arkady Strugatsky's translations from Japanese are online. You can just go look at them for free. There's no fretting about copyright, although you can also purchase it from all kinds of online vendors. And the stuff is still in libraries, except it's being deaccessioned gradually. If nobody's checked it out for however many years, it'll go on sale on Amazon. And it's usually pretty good prices, except the Strugatskys, because people know the Strugatskys are good. And some of the Macmillan editions, which were $14.95 in the 70s, are now online for $100. Now, that doesn't mean anybody's buying them, but it means that if you don't want to pay $100, you can't buy them on Amazon. That new translation of Roadside Picnic, which is around there somewhere, is done by a mathematician who lives in Texas named Olga Barmoshenko. It's much better than the previous edition, so I have hopes that the best stuff is going to get retranslated and treated as proper literature, which it really is. And there's some new interesting stuff that's also available in translation, and it's largely written by authors who aren't necessarily science fiction authors. Marion Schwartz's translation of Olga Slavnikova's novel 2017. This is a near future science fictional dystopia with very minor changes. It's set in 2017, right? So, for example, the heroine is spending money to get nanobots put into her bloodstream, which are going to make her more youthful. And the interesting, the 2017 part of the plot is that you have historical reenactors of the 1917 revolution getting helplessly pulled into actually reenacting it. So they're actually killing each other in their costumes. And there's also a fascinating admixture of the folklore of miners in the Urals. The Ural Mountains, in fact, were for centuries the site of all kinds of mining, including mining for gems, for malachite, for all kinds of semi-precious and precious gems are found there, so the novel mixes that in as well. On the other hand, novels by Viktor Pelevin, who could have started writing sooner but had another career and didn't actually start publishing till 1992, and now he's a very popular postmodern writer, and under the Pomo shine of his work is very deeply and seriously concerned with the depredations of consumer society, which for him proves more adept at taming a population than any kind of totalitarianism. So I can recommend those two writers now. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. As part of the 2013 Asian Culture Week celebration, sponsored annually by Creighton's Asian World Center, we've heard a talk by Sibylon Forrester, professor of Russian at Swarthmore College in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania. She spoke on the topic, East and West Connect and Compete, Anglo-American and Russian Science Fiction in the Cold War and Beyond. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday afternoon, September 9th, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, and to Maorong Jang, the Director of Creighton's Asian World Center, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.